You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks, just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest of the podcast this week is Marne Martin, CEO of Emberge.
There are a lot of cool things that I wouldn't be willing to pay for, right?
True.
So you have to make sure you're not just doing things because you're cool or you're curious, but because there's a market for that.
This is Marne. We dig into how she chose expense management over trendy markets to build sustainable competitive advantage. You'll hear how she applies elite athlete principles to boring software and uses one critical filter to separate profitable AI from expensive experiments. This is a candid conversation about finding opportunity where others see obstacles and what happens when you stop chasing the crowd. Well, hi, Marne. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
I'm so happy to be here. I love your podcast, so it's a real honor.
Good. Great to hear that. First compliment check. No, but it's we're going to talk about your journey that you started last year, January, at Emberge. Fascinated to see. I mean, I've been following you for about 4 or 5 months right now on LinkedIn, and that passion of the space that Emberge is taking ownership of is fascinated to see, let's put it that way. But before we start, what gives you energy or what drives you as an entrepreneur?
So, you know, I started my full-time career in technology in 1996, right? So it's almost 30 years. And, you know, obviously growing companies excites me as much as it did when I knew a lot less at 21 when I started this journey. But, you know, it excites me because you have the opportunity through technology and software companies to really drive innovation and how business and people's lives change. Like, that's what I love. And yes, we make a business out of it. The business is called software. It's a great business to be in. But we are doing really powerful things that shape each and every one of our lives, the businesses, our economies, and that's really meaningful to me.
Yeah, same to me. The impact that is creating and constantly having this opportunity to raise the bar again and reinvent the problem that has been solved so many times before. That fascinates me as well. That's why I've been involved.
It's in how you do it, right? It's the how you do it. And I think in the first wave of software, when you and I started our careers, we were thinking just about how you start thinking with mobile, how you leverage the internet, how you move off of paper, right? Exactly. That was, of course, the first wave, whether people were doing, you know, enterprise software at the time in SaaS, or they were doing it with on-premise. You know, you also had the first SMB-focused software companies. Like, that was unheard of prior to the 90s. And then, you know, some of the things I'll say have stayed the same. Like, I still think you have to focus on customers. If customers aren't happy, they won't renew. But the pace at which technology has changed, also the competition, how you build brand promise, how you tune unit economics. Now, of course, the pace at which we can embrace and do things with artificial intelligence has also changed dramatically from the 90s. So it continues to fascinate and inspire me. And I think, you know, what has stayed core to the approach I took out of even my student days, you know, in athletics and thinking about being a team captain and all these sorts of things, is that as I went into leadership and software, I still care about where you have culture, strategy, and that will to win in ways that are driven by team. That is what I think creates the positive outliers, the companies that are more successful, the teams that are more successful, whether that's in sports or certainly in business, I find that to be true.
Yeah, the drive to win, absolutely. And the question that you, of course, is like, what is then the formula to win? Which is hopefully we can dive into a couple of things that you learned over your career. So you worked at various companies in the field service management space at IFS, one of the companies that I know very well. And since recently, then since last year, Emburse. Emburse to me embodies something that for what it was at Unit 4, it was a module, but you have built a whole company around expense management at a pretty large size. What is now that you've worked for Emburse for, let me see, 1.5 years, what do you believe is the big idea behind the company and the reason for existence for a company like that?
So certainly, I was one of the early Concur users. I think one of the advantages that I bring to the table is I'm very comfortable with technology, very curious, and I like being an early adopter, but I also know how to monetize through the monetization cycles of software, et cetera. I think in this case, and I'll talk about the passion and the opportunity for Burst in a moment. But what I learned from early in my career, even prior to the dot-com crisis and some of the companies we had been investing in, is that sometimes you can be too early in an idea that you don't have enough customers to go build a 300, 500 million or a billion revenue company, right? So there, you might actually have a market that's not mature enough that you don't get beyond 20 or 50 million or what have you, which to some degree I would call a founder's curse, right? That you have validated an idea, you've gotten to quite a reasonably successful size of business, but it's not one that can scale because you don't have a big enough market and a big enough TAM. I think at the time when Concur first started out, and this was back in the 90s, remember? They weren't sure expense management would have the size of opportunity it was proven to be. And certainly when Bill led at SAP, the Concur acquisition, as well as Ariba, those were quite game changing, not just for SAP, but for the industry at the time, and also showed the success of a US approach to SaaS software, which I know is also relevant to this podcast and what we're talking about. However, after that, I think this area of software somewhat stagnated. I think it stagnated not only with kind of what the best of breed vendors, the approach they took, but I think actually more broadly, Office of the CFO. Like we have different categories of Office of the CFO software, but would you really say that any have been excessively innovative in the 2000s and 2010s? I don't
Not
think
that much,
so.
no.
So this is where, when I started my career, I thought all of the innovation already would have been absorbed. But come the time I started at Emburse in January 2024, it was very obvious that it hadn't, and actually the pace of innovation had stalled in the prior years. Emburse, the companies that were acquired to drive what now is a primarily organic growth story in SaaS software, were early innovators in the space that validated that you could have a mobile-first approach to expense management. You could
Sure.
start bringing in AI and hyper-automation alongside the data science insights across travel expense management, and also consolidate bringing in aspects of procure tech, travel and expense management reimbursement, AP automation, payments, into a platform that could scale. We are the largest independent travel and expense management business. I do think we are the most innovative, what you'll see with Emburse Intelligence as well as Emburse AI, and how we can continue accelerating the capabilities we give companies in what is a huge source of expenditure. Like expenses, if you add up, business expenditure around the world and money flows, this is huge. We all understand the importance of, say, CRM, right? That manages your customers and the revenue side. But your expenses are just as important to manage and to automate, and also to start driving more AI and the capabilities you can to reduce fraud and audit workflows. I don't know a
Yeah,
single
that's
finance
interesting.
person that doesn't say, hey, I'd like more time to be strategic. Maybe I'd like more time to just go home at 5 p.m., every night versus working to 10 p.m. And I want to start thinking about around ERP or the classic GL accounting modules and those workflows as a system of record. What can I do that's faster, easier, more accurate? And also, I don't have to waste time auditing both expenses and payments and dealing with that, because that is really inefficient time. And frankly, it's a waste.
Yeah, what I've always found fascinating, particularly also around that story around expense management, is okay, everybody sort of agrees that it's important because people spend money. And then there is this, how do you say, that gap that you don't know whether they've spent it, because there's
Yes.
maybe they spend it, with their own card and they have to claim it. And then at the end of the year, or the end of the quarter, the company is getting this enormous surprise because
Yeah.
everybody starts to claim their expenses back. And down goes your profit.
Yes, no one likes surprises. And the thing is, with where software is today, you should know in real time, right? And I think that's really what's exciting about is we have a ton of capabilities inside our platform and developing more innovation all the time. But we also can take in the aggregated information. There's these pet peeves that I have hated about expense management and how procure to pay works all of my career payments that, we are going to not only we're solving today, but we are going to continue to solve in ways that I'm delighted if I were using, because we do use Imburse ourselves. And also I know that customers need. So when you think about, a paper-based expense report, that's super inefficient. Like if you think about the need to buy something, whether that's a trip or, from a vendor or what have you, a different type of vendor that's not associated with travel, we know in advance there's a need. Okay. We call that a procurement, right? Or a spend need. But we're not actually making sure the best vendor, the cheapest vendor, the one that gives you maybe what you're looking for, even down the line in terms of how you pay or when you pay or rates or what have you. I think there's a lot of formulaic aspects that were built up over time in ERP and procurement software and some of the early expense software, but they're not actually changing the process, the intelligence in it. To know, hey, yes, we have this need, but when do we want to fulfill the need? Are we making sure the need is getting fulfilled in the cheapest way? Like, did we choose the best time to travel, right? If you're going to Germany, it's more expensive if you go the week of Oktoberfest, right? Things like that. You don't go to Cannes when the film festival's on, or Barcelona with Mobile World Congress if you don't need to. But on the other hand, if you do need to travel in those times, probably the traditional expense policy levels for your per diems or whatever else aren't going to work because it's going to be more expensive. All of that intelligence can be made real time in an application. And it's even easier now to not just use the configurable workflow engines and things like that that were already a game changer in software, but to use Gen AI and even more specifically the agentic AI to understand what people want to do, what people need to do, with also the real-time transparency and the controls. Like we can add a lot more fraud controls and kind of pre-audit reviews in real time, so that I made the joke at Imburse Emotion last week that you don't want the say the cow to leave the barn, referring back to my original cattle ranching days. Like you don't want the reimbursement or the payment to be made if it isn't accurate, correct, and validated.
That's true, exactly. So, I mean, I see sort of two things happening. On the one hand side, for the users, extreme convenience, almost to the point that they
Yes.
don't have to do nothing.
That's the goal.
Yeah, because I mean, we've been joking at Unit 4 at the time that the best UI is no UI. Just make it happen. And on the other hand, of course, on the corporate side, that everything is coming back almost at the moment that it happens, because that's where you
100% right. And that's, yes, 100% right. And you get it, right? Which is wonderful. I think that's where you can also start aggregating the information that's not only in our own system, but it is across systems that we can apply the intelligence to. Examples of that, at the travel side, they may use a TMC, right? An agency that's helping them with the bookings. They might have other procure tech solutions validating vendors that they're, people are allowed to purchase against. You might also have other credit cards, right? Not just Emburse issued cards or wallets or what have you, because we do a lot of fintech things too, but you might have other programs. When we bring that all in, it's almost like facial recognition software that we're creating a map around this need, this user, this expense that can be validated and be very, very accurate. It can be proactive, right? I think it also enables us to start giving forward-looking reports, and that's something we've launched with also our integrated T&E, that we're not just looking at historical spend, we're looking at, proactive spend. And I think that's also really important when you see that a lot of travel now is related to groups getting together. I didn't go back and look prior to COVID, but definitely since COVID, in a hybrid working world, which most of us are in, you have people getting together. But you can have the ability to say, all right, let's accelerate this meeting because we have a business need. We have the room and the budget to do it sooner, or let's postpone it. So we have to start thinking more about dynamic purchasing and expense management decisions versus react static ones.
I want to kind of switch the topic a little bit. Now you started with Emburse. The reason why you started is you took over the CEO role from someone. So you got your first 90 days. You see what the company's capable of, and then you come up with the direction you want to take it next. And I've seen when you were on stage, and I've seen the word movement come up, and I see how you clearly, I've also found a quote like, make a difference in everything you do, whether it's in the company you work for, the industry you serve. But that whole word of making the difference. Before the call, we also talked about your previous roles in other companies, about making things that are maybe not that sexy, something that people want to be involved in being part of. Explain why you take those type of decisions, or how why you prioritize as in the way you run the company and how you do that.
Now, first off, I am still hungry and passionate about what I do, okay? And I think, even with myself, you think about my story growing up, in the West, cattle ranching. I worked, all over the world in a lot of countries that women don't often work in their 20s and early 30s. And the path that I took, I like doing things that have a bit of challenge to them, right? And this comes back to what is meaningful. I think I'm, well, I know I'm learning all the time, and part of learning is you learn, you're curious from all sorts, right? But to go follow the lead and be, the millionth person in CRM or ERP or some of the more established categories of software, right? I always said that if you go to some countries that are often more difficult to do business in, you actually can make returns because there's going to be less competition for that opportunity.
Yeah, true.
Right. So that was one of the things when I went to Latin America and ran my first company at 27. Yes, I had the capability to be good at it. They trusted me. I'd already made the sponsors money. But it also was an opportunity that I wasn't fighting with people that it was their third opportunity, right? Because they didn't want to go to Latin America, right? So then as my career progressed, I became, if you will, the more experienced one or what have you. But it's taking those opportunities to really make a difference. And I think, for example, there's certain people, like if you would follow it wouldn't be as easy to make a difference. Like, Mark Benioff made a huge difference in CRM. Okay, maybe I could go to CRM and put agentic AI and reimagine CRM. Okay, that might be an interesting challenge after I've sorted out expense management. But I always have looked for areas that you could create kind of an N equals one. Like the differentiation was the innovation and attention and brand positioning you brought to that sector, right? And
True.
to be fair, learning from the case study of Salesforce, when I was in my 20s watching their development at the beginning of my career, they created that category. It wasn't that CRM wasn't already in Oracle, where Mark came from, or others, but he created that. No, this is a meaningful category that spawned, a revolution and the need for a 360 view of a customer. We're now
Fascinating.
doing the same. And again, it's not that Concur didn't come first, but we are creating with Emburse Intelligence and Emburse AI. And frankly, even though I've worked with AI for decades, this is one of the most exciting times I've ever had in my career with AI, with the speed at which you can do things with Gen AI and agentic AI, and the fact that with compliance with convenience, we have so much clean real-time data. It makes it so much easier to do cool things with artificial intelligence, right? And this is where expense management. Yes, maybe people don't think it's sexy. Maybe they didn't think service management was sexy either, but you have so much data and the opportunity to bring artificial intelligence and automation, hyper automation into it, into those workflows, and do it in very meaningful ways where there's quite clear outcomes, outcomes in terms of people productivity, controls, accuracy, which equate to business value realization and bottom line money.
Yeah, well said, well said. A couple of things that I want to pick up on. Let me see. You mentioned two times like what's meaningful, and I think that is the right point. It goes back to thinking about the customer, what the customer values, and what is critical to them, high on their agenda. You also mentioned the word curiosity. You mentioned AI a couple of times with agentic combinations there. I see so much happening in the industry, like, and I completely agree with you. There's the change of technology is at the moment at a peak where I've never seen it before, and the opportunity is crazy. Question at the end is, how do you then make decisions that the technology that you are going to incorporate in your suite is not only cool but also meaningful? And because there's so much opportunity and choice, you know, and you're leading an organization of 850 plus people. Everybody's making decisions on a day-to-day basis. How do you keep that on track towards doing the right thing?
Look, I think I would add another category of security, data security on that as well, because I think that's even more critical now with where we're going. So definitely data security is the third leg of the stool, if you will. I was fortunate enough early in my career that I basically built out from an original Excel spreadsheet companies that were national telcos or what became New York Stock Exchange traded companies, that I went from Excel to 1 billion enterprise valuation, 2.5 billion enterprise valuation before we sold those companies. And I had to understand that intersection of profitable growth, the product investments we needed to make, as alongside the go-to-market. Okay. And certainly talent, how you manage the human capital talent to succeed has to be inside that triangle for anyone to be successful. So, I had perhaps an unconventional career in that regard that I had so much responsibility early, but it really took what was already a talent I had to kind of have an instinctive pace and understanding of what customers wanted. Also, because I still think as a customer, like when I evaluate what we're building, what we're developing, how we're pitching, I still say, would I buy this? Would I be happy with this offering? And also, what would I pay for this? Right? Because there are a lot of cool things that I wouldn't be willing to pay for, right?
True.
So you have to make sure you're not just doing things because you're cool or you're curious, but because there's a market for that. And I definitely learned that early on when we were investing in pre.com crisis companies that we just couldn't raise enough cash to keep them alive until the market was ready. And at that time we even looked at investing in quantum computing. Thank goodness we didn't because no one still figured that out, even though it remains a huge potential. So you have to always remain skeptical in the sense that you think about a customer and would I buy what we're putting out at the prices we would put out?
Let me make a small interruption here. Margaret just made an excellent remark that sets her product strategy philosophy apart from conventional startup thinking. The simple principle, would I pay for this, eliminated wasted innovation and forced them to focus only on profitable AI implementations. This is what remarkable software companies do. They acknowledge they cannot please everyone. They master the art of curiosity and then create new value possibilities instead of incrementally improving old ones. You want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
I also think, alongside that, thinking like a customer, you have to make sure that you are trustworthy, not just trustworthy to your employees. And I think by being trustworthy, that doesn't mean that we don't have a performance culture. Okay. In a performance culture, you need things from employees to stay employed, right? So you have to be talking about trust with a positive culture and the performance. With customers as well, I remember reading a fascinating study that customers have to be able to trust you. But that trust doesn't mean that you're necessarily perfect. They have to be getting value from the software. And they also need to have the trust if something happens, you will fix it, you will make it right. And again, that doesn't mean that making it right has to be always free. That's not what I'm saying, but that you will have the dedication to treating their business as mission critical. And I will tell you, that is something that I still feel in my heart, that I care about each of our customers' businesses as if it's my own, in the sense that our software needs to work. It needs to do what's behind the brand promise. And I take it very seriously that it works. And if there's something that I need to do to help get the outcomes our customers need, I am still available to do that. The same, I take it very seriously that we need to be a great place to work. I take it very seriously also with our sponsors that, yes, in private equity, I've also run public companies that, we have shareholder trust, we have others. So, this concept of trust and responsibility really is part of my DNA and has been since I was a child. We just now express it in how we grow companies and deliver innovation.
Yeah, well said. First of all, that would I buy it? And a lot of things, people always think, yeah, I would buy it because it's so cool. But actually, what would you pay for this? And that is the bar that you have to stretch, which is a very good lens to put on any R&D development that you put in. The trustworthiness, I like it as well. And now you were talking about your third leg of the stool, security, which a lot of companies, when the coolness comes in, often forget, because then it's about getting that out and forgetting that it also can break and lead to enormous disasters. What I like about your point as well is like it's all about becoming and creating a profitable business. I've also been part of a private equity organization, or an organization that became part of private equity, and I also know how much the focus then shifts towards profitability, sometimes at the expense of what the customer. Of that customer, right? How do you balance that? I mean, my own perspective is the more we focus on the value of the customer, the more value will come back, and that drives the profitability. I mean, how do you look at that?
You know, it's interesting. I made this joke the other day that Agriculture and private equity software, unit economics, like how you tune the unit economics is always critical, right? You think about production yields from agriculture and other things, and in software, we think about CAC to LTV, right? Customer acquisition cost to long-term value. So, in understanding the unit economics, and this, I think, is the biggest difference between private equity and VC. And certainly, I did run some, I call it Marnie's MBA course when I came into Emburse on understanding what are the profitable customers and what are the unprofitable customers. Because, I've never been in the business. Again, this comes from my father and grandfather and mother and grandmother, all my family, talking about the value of a dollar, right, as a little kid and growing up. I've never been in the business of wasting money. And what's interesting to me is there's a lot of venture capital companies that waste a ton of money. Okay. And the thing is, I don't think they have to. Certainly, when you're funding innovation and other things, and sometimes fixing things with customers or what have you, you have to invest some money. But, now I'll say that there's some fundamental models that you see in VC that will never be profitable. And even when I came into Emburse and how I've looked at this, and this started back to when we had some of the first click to pay, mobile banking, all these different trends, is I always said, like, how thin is the line of profitability? Is this a sustainable business model where you have, again, going back to my economics and finance education, is this something that you can scale profitably with enough comparative or competitive advantage in a way that is healthy for both customers and the company? Because if you get into a zero-sum relationship that, hey, the customer has to do all the winning or the company does all the winning, that's never viable long term. One or the other may squeeze something out in the short term, but it's never viable or healthy in the long term. So,
Exactly.
because again, going back to when I did the Excel spreadsheets and kind of, my childhood of talking about unit economics, you have to be always tuning the unit economics in ways that are fair to the delivery of value to the customer. And that's also what prompts them to trust you to buy more, cross-sell, upsell beyond a basic renewal, and making sure that you're fairly rewarded for the innovation you've put out and satisfying the sponsors, et cetera. And I think that there are smarter and dumber ways of doing that, frankly. I think that sometimes private equity has management teams that don't understand kind of the guts of the business. So they take cost out in ways that actually hurt the business, rather than what I prefer and the approach I take. Is I think of companies, how I make them elite athletes. Like, how do I make my company, a LeBron James, right? A Michael Phelps. There's a gazillion, Navratilova. Like, there's a gazillion female and male athletes I can think of, Federer, all sorts that, Steffi Graf, that have had very long, successful careers. That they had the resiliency to have long and successful careers, but it's also because they kept honing their skills. They kept making sure their body fitness was there, et cetera. And that's where I think you really can think about companies in a way that a great company is a great company, whether it's private equity owned, public, or owned by a strategic. And you have to continue tuning that company like an elite athlete. And that's how you create healthy companies that continue to thrive. And we'll continue to also hopefully innovate. The one thing I'll say that maybe is a little bit my special sauce is that I am probably the, at least as far as I know, and I never met Steve Jobs personally. My chief product officer did also work for Steve Jobs, so but I am one of the most curious people I know in a CEO seat. And I will say that, the businesses that I run typically do innovate faster because I am inherently curious, but I'm not curious about driving innovation that we can't sell, right? Then it's what I call wasted innovation that instead should be done, through nonprofits or something else.
Exactly. Well said. Well said. Well, I mean, I wrote the book The Remarkable Effect, chapter 4, trade 4. remarkable software companies master the art of curiosity. So that one is okay in the box. You made a very strong point about profit and comparative and co or competitive advantage. I believe these two go hand in hand. A lot of companies, especially when things aren't going that well, they start to optimize for other things. But how do you keep, well, I mean, I think you answered it to that extent, but that competitive advantage also, of course, has to do in terms of where you focus your business and where you say no to. When you started with Emburse and you did an analysis of which are the profitable customers and which are the unprofitable customers, did that influence your go-to-market strategy in terms of who you now say no to?
100%. It impacted not just our financial tuning to move towards being a Rule of 50 company, growing but increasing EBITDA and delivering innovation at a faster pace, but it also looked at how we drove the efficiency and actually clarification of what were sales-led and product-led growth strategies and what is the role of customer success not only today, but as you start embracing more automation and AI, because one of the things that I found, especially in the SMB, where you might be servicing 10,000, 20,000 customers at a time, that a conventional segmentation model where you're hiring people to do that might actually not understand what the customer needs now in this era of AI that we are in, as well as really good AI does, right? Plus, of course, delivering a great product that customers love to use and, the product secure and always up. And, that's all table stakes. But it's really interesting that we're getting to a point now that, with AI, you can actually understand customers. Again, not the complex enterprise customers, those you have so many stakeholders, you have to really build the relationships. But a lot of the customers in the businesses that are SMB or even into the mid-market, you can actually understand what value is to them in ways that it's a little easier to understand. And then you can start applying AI to that. What we also did, and this was interesting, is one of the products we really said, hey, what do those customers really need from us? So we did some additional market research. But we also tried to take a fresh look at kind of a product-led growth strategy with those customers to say, hey, we actually can get higher conversion rates doing a digital selling with digital implementation strategy, right? So we pivoted that product and actually tested it, even white labeling with a major regional bank, to show that we could do this and actually we could resell our software product with their card product in a way that was so fully white labeled that the customers really didn't know we were providing the software. So that actually has given now an additional growth vector against some of the VC-backed companies that are in the SMB, that we have better CAC to LTV numerical advantage now because we're doing more of a digital versus people-led strategy. And we can start waking up other banks across the US and elsewhere that these other VC companies that mandate that customers use their cards or wallets are competitive to the bank's business. The other thing, speaking of competitive advantage, is of course, around CAC to LTV, you have to understand retention. In the SMB, there, you often, retention is the concern as customer acquisition costs. Retention is also the concern. If you actually buddy up with more of the banks, their customers are actually quite sticky. So you need to find and always be open and curious, not just about the product side, but the commercial sides, finding what creates more stickiness in a customer, what can improve CAC to LTV in ways that actually give a better customer and buying experience, right? That's ultimately what they want. And then I'll say, as you get into the mid-market, often it's how you help those companies grow, take market share, et cetera, understanding that. When you get into the enterprise and the multinational, there I'll say, a lot of these businesses have bought so much software now at this point over the last 25, 30 years. that some of them don't trust themselves to innovate and do the change management. So there, we have to always be thinking of how to make the software also in the enterprise category so easy to use and so delightful to use that they don't have to do complex and expensive change management. Because most of these companies aren't good at it. So if you can make the attraction to use the software, in this case, expense management, travel, if you create it like bees to honey, you want the users to want to use the software. And that also lessens the demands on these enterprises to do change management, which
True,
means
certainly.
then they will be more apt to make the change, whether that's off of Concur or to think, hey, I actually shouldn't be using the clunky thing that's in the ERP system for expense management. I should be using Emburse. You know, I'll get more users to give me their receipts faster. I'll have better control, less fraud, more real-time information. Everything is a win-win-win. And by the way, it's really easy for the users to learn it. It's easy for the employees to learn it. That is really what software should be like.
Well said. Great pitch.
Well,
Great,
you know.
great, great plug. No, but you're completely right. And I mean, again, talking about my book, it ticks trait number two in a fantastic way, because that is about, remarkable software companies offer something valuable and desirable, and it's the combination of the two. The valuable part is, of course, like a no-brainer, but how many companies lose the battle at the end because it's not desirable? Nobody wants it or wants to keep it. And I think that is the art of what is possible today with the technology that is coming around. Well, it's coming around the corner, that's there. Rounding it off, from all your experience, and I mean, having been involved in the AI space now for 2.5 decades.
Pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. What would be a do and what would be a don't that you would, like to share with other entrepreneurs in this space, especially the entrepreneurs that are overwhelmed with the opportunities. How do you go about what is the do and don't in terms of making the right choices there?
Look, I think, and this is, I guess, is a little bit of life advice woven into also AI founder advice. You know, when I was in my early career, my husband actually reminds me of this because we've been together now 25 years and about to our 22nd anniversary. And he reminds me that when we first met, I would get stressed out that I had so many opportunities. Like, how would I decide what I wanted to do? Okay. I think in this, to some degree, that's been that way since the 90s. Like, I recently met a gentleman actually yesterday who had done one of the very, very first NLP engines in the 90s, right? You know, a lot of the telco and defense were on the, you know, at the cutting edge of what we were doing with AI back then, you know, et cetera. So I think you can take an approach of, hey, I'm going to be like an academic or a nonprofit. I'm going to try and solve, say, climate change or something like that, these huge modeling challenges, or I want to solve quantum computing once and for all. Okay. There, you know, I'd say you're more acting as a scientist or an academic. Something like that, right? And to, there are founders and innovation. If you think about how patents are won or a lot of the early stage, that is definitely like that. And then, you know, you can get grants and, you know, kind of earn a living that way and make some meaningful change. But in the business I am in, which is doing business, you have to start with almost an idea of the destination. You need to say, yes, this is the problem I'm going to solve. That's pretty common. But it goes back to what I said before, and this is some of the mistake, you know, I saw some of the founders even before the dot-com crisis doing, and it continues, is, okay, you have a cool idea, you're smart people, there's all these AI tools. Who's actually going to use and buy this, like to get your first million of revenue, your first 10 million of revenue, your first 50 million of revenue? 50, 100 million of revenue. Like, I was talking to some private equity folks after I went to Silicon Valley, and the founder who is at Google and a variety of other places, Glean AI, you know, they're over 100 million in revenue. doing really cool things. Some of the things they do, the pre and post processing and what have you, is interesting to talk about related to our own Emburse AI. Okay, so they've grown to 100 million in ARR or revenue, I'm not sure. Like, okay, will that kind of, what's the top line of that business? That's already a very successful business, but how are they thinking about that next phase of growth? And now growing so many opportunities up to even $1 billion of revenue, it is a very long way from your first idea to $1 billion in revenue. That's obvious, but you have to think more about the destination. And going back to the competitive advantage part, can I sustain my competitive advantage in what I'm doing in AI to last 10 years, to even last 5 years? Because I really think the people that are getting good at agentic AI, like Emburse and others, we're going to get so far ahead in the next 3 years that I'm not sure the people that aren't using it already will ever catch up before it's a commodity.
That's about making choices.
No, that's what I'm saying. And if agentic AI becomes a commodity and you still have these laggards, which frankly, some of the laggards are the biggest companies in the world, will they ever catch up, or will instead they get supplanted? So definitely the next 10 years is going to be exciting. I'm really happy to be a part of it. And it's been a pleasure to be part of this podcast. Thank you so much for what you do.
Perfect. Good. So where can people go to find out more about Emburse or to say hi to you?
So I love people saying hi, so that's good. You can find me on LinkedIn, or I think ZoomInfo also has my email based on the number of emails I get from random solicitations. But as a funny thing, that's definitely, people have figured out how to do that. But LinkedIn is a great place for reaching out. And then
Exactly.
we've really worked hard to have a lot of information on the Emburse.com website. So hopefully that gives everyone a feel for what we're doing as a company and who we are, as well as the great talent we have.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for sharing all the wisdom. I mean, there's a ton of information in here, and a lot of nuggets that people can reflect upon and think about how they applied it to their own business. So thanks for that, and I'll keep following you in what you're going to do in the next couple of years with Inverse. Thanks.
We'll keep following each other.
Exactly. And this wraps up my conversation with Marne and Martin, CEO of Emburse. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Ton. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.